About this time, an ambitious young reporter from New York arrived one morning at Gatsby's door and asked him if he had anything to say. "Anything to say about what?" inquired Gatsby. It transpired after a confused 5 minutes that the man had heard Gatsby's name around his office in a connection which he either wouldn't reveal or didn't fully understand. This was his day off, and with laudable initiative, he had hurried out to see. It was a random shot, and yet the reporter's instinct was right. Gatsby's notoriety, spread about by the hundreds who had accepted his hospitality and so become authorities upon his past, had increased all summer until he fell just short of being news. Just why these inventions were a source of satisfaction to James Gatz of North Dakota isn't easy to say. James Gatz. That was Gatsby's name. He had changed it at the age of 17, and at the specific moment that witnessed the beginning of his career, when he saw Dan Cody's yacht drop anchor over the most insidious flat on Lake Superior. It was James Gatz who had been loafing along the beach that afternoon, but it was already Jay Gatsby who borrowed a rowboat, pulled out to the Tuolumne, and informed Cody that a wind might catch him and break him up in half an hour. I suppose he'd had the name ready for a long time, even then. Jay Gatsby of West Egg, Long Island, sprang from his platonic conception of himself, and to this conception he was faithful to the end. For over a year he had been beating his way along the south shore of Lake Superior as a clam digger and a salmon fisher, or in any other capacity that brought him food and bed. He knew women early, and since they spoiled him, he became contemptuous of them. But his heart was in a constant, turbulent riot. The most grotesque and fantastic conceits haunted him. For a while, these reveries provided an outlet for his imagination. But he was still searching for something to do on the day that Dan Cody's yacht dropped anchor. Cody was 50 years old then, a product of the Nevada silver fields, of the Yukon, of every rush for metal since 75. The transactions in Montana copper that made him many times a millionaire found him physically robust, but on the verge of soft-mindedness. To young Gatz, resting on his oars and looking up at the rail deck, that yacht represented all the beauty and glamour in the world. I suppose he smiled at Cody. He had probably discovered that people liked him when he smiled. At any rate, Cody asked him a few questions and found that he was quick and extravagantly ambitious. A few days later, he took him to Duluth and bought him a blue coat, 6 pairs of white duck trousers, and a yachting cap. And when the Tuolumne left for the West Indies and the Barbary Coast, Gatsby left too. He was employed in a vague personal capacity, and the arrangement lasted 5 years, during which the boat went 3 times around the continent. It might have lasted indefinitely, except for the fact that Dan Cody inhospitably died. It was from Cody that he inherited money, a legacy of $25,000. He didn't get it. He never understood the legal device that was used against him. He told me all this very much later, but I've recounted it now with the idea of exploding those first wild rumors about his antecedents, which weren't even faintly true. For several weeks I didn't see him. Mostly I was in New York, trotting around with Jordan and trying to ingratiate myself with her senile aunt. But finally I went over to his house one Sunday afternoon. I hadn't been there 2 minutes when somebody brought Tom Buchanan in for a drink. Moved by an irresistible impulse, Gatsby turned to Tom, who had accepted the introduction as a stranger. "I believe we've met somewhere before, Mr. Buchanan." "Oh, yes?" said Tom, obviously not remembering. "About 2 weeks ago." "That's right. You were with Nick here." "I know your wife," continued Gatsby. "That's so." Tom turned to me. "You live near here, Nick?"
"Next door."
"That's so." On the following Saturday night, Tom came with Daisy to Gatsby's party. Perhaps his presence gave the evening its peculiar quality of oppressiveness. It stands out in my memory from Gatsby's other parties that summer. They were the same people, or at least the same sort of people, the same profusion of champagne, the same many-colored, many-keyed commotion. But I felt an unpleasantness in the air that hadn't been there before. They arrived at twilight, and, as we strolled out among the sparkling hundreds, Daisy's voice was playing murmurous tricks in her throat. "These things excite me so," she whispered. "If you want to kiss me any time during the evening, Nick, just let me know and I'll be glad to arrange it for you. Just mention my name."
"Look around," suggested Gatsby.
"I'm looking around. I'm having a marvelous..."
"You must see the faces of many people you've heard about."
Tom's arrogant eyes roamed the crowd.
"We don't go around very much. In fact, I was just thinking I don't know a soul here."
"Perhaps you know that lady."
Gatsby indicated a gorgeous, scarcely human orchid of a woman who sat in state under a white plum tree. Tom and Daisy stared with that peculiarly unreal feeling that accompanies the recognition of a hitherto ghostly celebrity of the movies.
"She's lovely," said Daisy.
"The man bending over her is her director."
He took them ceremoniously from group to group.
"Mrs. Buchanan? Mr. Buchanan. The polo player."
"I'd rather not be the polo player," said Tom. "I'd rather look at all these famous people in oblivion."
Daisy and Gatsby danced. I remember being surprised by his graceful, conservative foxtrot. I had never seen him dance before. Then they sauntered over to my house and sat on the steps for half an hour, while at her request I remained watchfully in the garden.
"In case there's a fire or a flood," she explained, "or any act of God."
Tom appeared from his oblivion as we were sitting down to supper together.
"Do you mind if I eat with some people over here?" he said. "A fellow's getting off some funny stuff."
"Go ahead," answered Daisy. We were at a particularly tipsy table.
"How do you feel, Miss Baedeker?"
The girl addressed was trying unsuccessfully to slump against my shoulder. At this inquiry, she sat up and opened her eyes.
"What?"
It was like that. Almost the last thing I remember was standing with Daisy and watching the moving picture director and his star.
"I like her," said Daisy. "I think she's lovely."
But the rest offended her. She was appalled by West Egg, this unprecedented place that Broadway had begotten upon a Long Island fishing village. I sat on the front steps with them while they waited for their car. It was dark here in front, only the bright door sent 10 square feet of light volleying out into the soft black morning. Sometimes a shadow moved against the dressing room blind above, gave way to another shadow, an indefinite procession of shadows, who rouged and powdered in an invisible glass.
"Who is this Gatsby, anyhow?" demanded Tom suddenly. "Some big bootlegger."
"Where'd you hear that?" I inquired.
"I didn't hear it. I imagined it. A lot of these newly rich people are just big bootleggers, you know."
"Not Gatsby," I said. Daisy began to sing with the music in a husky, rhythmic whisper, bringing out a meaning in each word that it had never had before and would never have again.
"I'd like to know who he is and what he does," insisted Tom, "and I think I'll make a point of finding out."
"I can tell you right now," she answered. "He owns some drugstores, a lot of drugstores. He built them up himself."
The dilatory limousine came rolling up the drive.
"Good night, Nick," said Daisy.
Her glance left me and sought the lighted top of the steps, where 3 o'clock in the morning, a neat, sad little waltz of that year was drifting out the open door. What was it up there in the song that seemed to be calling her back inside? I stayed late that night. Gatsby asked me to wait until he was free, and I lingered in the garden until the inevitable swimming party had run up, chilled and exalted from the black beach, until the lights were extinguished in the guest rooms overhead. When he came down the steps at last, the tan skin was drawn unusually tight on his face, and his eyes were bright and tired.
"She didn't like it," he said.
"Of course she did."
"She didn't like it. She didn't have a good time."
He was silent, and I guessed at his unutterable depression.
"I feel far away from her. It's hard to make her understand."
He wanted nothing less of Daisy than that she should go to Tom and say, "I never loved you." After she had obliterated 4 years with that sentence, they could decide upon the more practical measures to be taken. One of them was that after she was free, they were to go back to Louisville and be married from her house, just as if it were 5 years ago. "She doesn't understand. She used to be able to understand. We'd sit for hours." He broke off and began to walk up and down a desolate path of fruit rinds and crushed flowers. "I wouldn't ask too much of her," I ventured. "You can't repeat the past."
"Can't repeat the past? Why, of course you can."
He looked around him wildly as if the past were lurking here in the shadow of his house just out of reach of his hand. "I'm going to fix everything just the way it was before. She'll see." He talked a lot about the past, and I gathered that he wanted to recover something, some idea of himself, perhaps, that had gone into loving Daisy. His life had been confused and disordered since then, but if he could once return to a certain starting place and go over it all slowly, he could find out what that thing was. One autumn night, 5 years before, they had been walking down the street when the leaves were falling, and they came to a place where there were no trees, and the sidewalk was white with moonlight. They stopped here and turned toward each other. It was a cool night with that mysterious excitement in it which comes at the two changes of the year. His heart beat faster as Daisy's white face came up to his own. He knew that when he kissed this girl and forever wed his unutterable visions to her perishable breath, his mind would never romp again like the mind of God. So he waited, listening for a moment longer to the tuning fork that had been struck upon a star. Then he kissed her. At his lips' touch, she blossomed for him like a flower, and the incarnation was complete. Through all he said, even through his appalling sentimentality, I was reminded of something, an elusive rhythm, a fragment of lost words, that I had heard somewhere a long time ago. For a moment a phrase tried to take shape in my mouth, and my lips parted like a dumb man's, as though there was more struggling upon them than a wisp of startled air. They made no sound, and what I had almost remembered was uncommunicable forever.